I greet you with a very happy Friday and hope that you're going to have a wonderful weekend that includes being with the people in your home congregation. Everybody needs a home congregation. Everybody needs to be there, encouraging, being encouraged, worshiping, fellowship, praying, praising, studying, and perhaps even doing some of the teaching, definitely doing some of the serving. So everybody needs that. If you don't have a place like that, you need to go out and find it and then stay plugged in there. If you're looking right now actively and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, it is our ongoing invitation to you to come and check us out. Maybe we'll be the place that you'll decide to call your church home. I want you to open your Bible today to 2 Samuel chapter number 5. And understand that starting today, we're going to have information that comes out of the Chronicles as well. This is a period of history where God provides the testimony of two witnesses. And this is helpful because when you've got two different eyes on the same topic, they emphasize different things or they fill in information based on their own interests that the other person maybe didn't put in. Sometimes we have clarification of verbiage or chronological information. And so that's why it's really useful to us to have these two witnesses to draw from. Now, this is the situation that I really want to remind you of. David actually became king over Judah upon the death of King Saul back in 1017 BC. The first 2 years, there was a problem with Ishbaal, the surviving son of King Saul, who was supported by Abner, his uncle, and the commander of the northern Israeli forces. We end up with a civil war. Once that gets resolved in 1015, it takes a little bit for things to calm down from that civil war, especially since we had the assassination of Abner, and then we had the assassination of Ishbaal. I don't know that David was immediately crowned king over United Israel after the death of those two men. I think it may have taken a couple of years in order for things to get resolved enough that everyone felt comfortable with him being their king. But when they did, they gathered together to Hebron, which is where he had his king, or his headquarters, his royal throne during the time he was over Judah tribe. That's pretty far south in the complete area of the Promised Land. And I think David may have understood from the very beginning, oh, that's going to need to change. We're going to need a place other than the capital city of the Judah tribe. And so I think it could be that after the sabbatical year, the first sabbatical year of David's kingdom, which would have been from the fall of 1011 till the fall of 1010, I think David began to ponder how to adopt a capital city that everyone would be happier with, more centrally located, but also one that had not been attached to a particular tribe, like the tribe of Judah. And so he sees the city of Jebus as being the perfect place to take a hold of that. And so in 2 Samuel chapter number 5, verse 6, it says this, and the parallels over in 1 Chronicles 11, if you want to see it. the king and his men went to Jerusalem, which at this time is just known as Yebus. It's gone through a lot of different name changes. When Abraham knew it, it was Salam or Salem, the peace city. That's where Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, that was running things as the priest of God Most High. But eventually the Canaanites, particularly a group of Canaanites, took over the city, and they gave it a name, Jebus. And that's what it's been known as ever since. When they came into the Promised Land, the Israelis burned the city down. Obviously not the walls made of rock, but everything else got burned down. But they never occupied it. The territory that included this burned-up ruin went into the hands of the Benjamites, but they never went up and rebuilt this city for themselves. They just left it alone, and eventually some Jebusites came back, rebuilt the city, made it stronger, and the Benjamites never tried to kick them out again. And so it's been in Canaanite hands ever since. It's never belonged to Benjamin. It's right on the border between Benjamin and Judah. Judah never tried to take it, so it doesn't belong to them. And so this is a city, a very strong city, a city that has a connection to the worship of the true God back in the story of Abraham, but it's never been occupied by Israelis. And so David seems to see that as the perfect place to put his new capital, and I think it's a wise choice. So the king and his men went up to Jebus against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who turned around and said to David, so you have to picture them up on their big, very strong stone walls, "You'll not come in here. The blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking David cannot come in here. So they put so much confidence in their walls that they believed that they could just put blind and lame people up on the wall and they would be sufficient to protect the city from any invaders. It was a way of mocking the Israelis. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. Now, Zion is another name for Jebus. Now, Jebus is a little oval hill, elongated oval hill, to the south of what we call the Temple Mount today. It's about a tenth of a mile wide, I think, or something like that, and it's very narrow. And it had steep embankments, particularly on the eastern side and a little bit more on the western side and on the south side where the two places came together. And then on the north end, it was kind of level, but they just built really super strong walls up there, and that's where they put their fortified buildings in order to keep it from being taken from that direction. So that's what's referred to as Zion. That's the true meaning of it. That is the city of David. And if you go to Israel today, they're doing great archaeological work on the ancient city of David, Ir David, the city of David. And you should definitely go if you go there. So David said on that day, "Whoever will strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind." That's in quotations, as it should be in my English Standard Version, because he's actually throwing the words of the Jebusites back at them, who are hated by David's soul. So he's talking about those guys that think they're so smart, that they don't even have to worry about protecting their own walls. He says, you're going to have to go up a water shaft. Now, don't think of a water shaft as vertical. Think of it as a little elongated cave. Because I've been through one of these a couple of times now on Zion's eastern side, the City of David's side. You have an option when you do some of your tours. You can go through Hezekiah's tunnel, which is still wet. It was a diversion tunnel to move water from the only active water source on Mount Zion, which is, again, the City of David, we're talking about Jebus, down to the pool on the south side of the town. Or you can go through what's called a dry Canaanite tunnel. And that's the one I took, because this is the one that we're talking about here. In ancient times, the Gihon Spring, which is the water source I was just talking about, it poured out of the eastern side of Jebus through a whole bunch of these little caves, these little crevices, and it watered the valley to the east of the city, and they used that water to plant all sorts of trees and bushes and crops. But eventually, in the time of Hezekiah, they didn't want that water flowing out that direction anymore because they didn't want their enemies to use it. So they plugged up all those points of departure for the water and diverted it to the Siloam pool to the south side of the city. So all of this is to explain to you, in the time of David, there would have been little streams coming down off the east side of the city of Jebus underneath the walls. And David knew that those water sources were coming from somewhere inside the city itself. And so he tells his military, the only way we're going to get in there is if some of you climb through one of those and make it all the way to the water source, to the Gihon Spring. And then you can overpower whatever guards they have and then come around and let us in. You can open the doors and let us in. So that's the plan. And so that's exactly what they did. We are told in the other passage, let me make sure I get there now, it's 1 Chronicles, chapter number 11. I apologize, but I have to switch gears here a little bit. This is 1 Chronicles 11, 6. David said, whoever strikes the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander. Now, it is evident to me from those words that David, after he became king, was still very angry at Joab, his nephew, for having assassinated Abner, the commander of the forces of northern Israel, and probably removed him from his position as commander. But now he opens it up that whoever can do this infiltration operation, he gets to be the commander. And guess what? It says in the text, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first. So that's how he became chief. So he gets his old job back because he climbs up through one of these pipes. Now, don't think of a pipe like a clay pipe or concrete pipe. I want you to think of like a cave that's very narrow, and you have to kind of squeeze through, and maybe sometimes you have to duck a little bit, and there's water running underneath, past your feet, maybe up to your knees, up to your legs, up to your waist, your hip, maybe up to your chest from time to time. And so he and his men probably only with some torches, go up through this. And when I've walked through this, it's completely dry now, and they've put some concrete at the bottom to make it easier to walk through. And it takes me about 10 minutes or so to get through it. So these guys go against the water flow in the dark through all of this, and they make it up to the pool from which this water is coming that's inside the walls. And whatever night guard there may have been, they kill. And then they open the gates. And so they take the city completely intact. Nothing happens to the city itself. And that's important. The First Chronicles passage goes on to say, David lived in the stronghold, therefore it was called the City of David. And then he built the city all around from the Milo in complete circuit, and Joab repaired the rest of the city. Now the Milo, we're pretty sure, it is the terraced part on the east side of the northern tip of the City of David. It's the area that holds up a great big, what must have been the biggest house in town on the north side. And that seems to be where David takes up residence when he moves into the city. And so David redoes that whole northern section of the city of Jebus. And his nephew, Joab, who's now the commander of the army, he takes care of revamping everything elsewhere, which I'm sure included making sure nobody could climb up that water tunnel again, because he wouldn't want anybody doing the same thing that he did to them, to David. And so over in 2 Samuel chapter 5, there's an interesting little finish to this story. It says in verse number 8, let me read it again. David said on that day, whoever shall strike the Jebusites, let him get up by the water shaft to attack, quote, the lame and the blind, end quote, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. Now it's interesting. Whoever's writing 2 Samuel attaches the idea that blind and lame people are not allowed to come within the holiest worship area of the temple later, because David said that they couldn't come in there because he wrote it here. And that is an interesting historical realignment that always makes me kind of go, wow, that's interesting that they made those connections. But David built the city all around from the Milo inward. David became greater and greater, for he who is the God of the armies, that is, he who is over the armies, was with him. And so this is how David takes possession of the city of Jerusalem intact in 1010 BC. And then he makes it even stronger. The next thing on his mind is to get the Ark of the Covenant into the city. And for this one, I want you to go to the Chronicles passage. Go to 1 Chronicles chapter 13. The parallel comes up in chapter 6 of 2 Samuel. And there's so many things that happen here, very in close proximity to one another, it's sometimes hard to get the chronology just exactly perfect. So we've got things happening a lot in 1010 BC. So this is the 1 Chronicles 13 passage. David consulted with the commanders of thousands and of hundreds, with every leader. So now he's got the capital city of Jebus, which he's going to rename Jerusalem. He's got control of that, and so he talks to his army leaders. David said to all the assembly of Israel, If it seems good to you and from He who is our God, let us send abroad to our brothers who remain in all the lands of Israel, as well as to the priests and Levites in the city that have pasture lands, that they may be gathered to us. Then let us bring the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it in the days of Saul. Now, it is interesting that in the early days of King Saul, two years, when Saul was still being led by the Spirit of God, he did have connections to the Ark of the Covenant. He did move it from place to place and talk to God using the Urim and the Thummim. But once he lost God's support, apparently he quit trying to go to God at the Ark of the Covenant, at Kiriath Jearim, because God won't talk to him anyway. And so that's what David is referencing here, is that all this time that Saul was on the throne, or most of the time that Saul was on the throne, the Ark of the Covenant was just sitting over there at Kiriath Jearim, and nothing was happening. Let's bring it to the new capital city. Let's bring our king's throne to his capital city. And so verse 4 says, all the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. So everybody thinks it's a good idea. It says, David assembled all Israel from the Sihor. In our English Standard Version, it says Nile, because the Sihor is the easternmost branch of the Nile. And in this time period, it was the eastern border of Egypt, and therefore the western border of Israel. So he sent for everybody from the Nile, or the Sihor of Egypt, to Lebo Hamat. Lebo Hamat is apparently a little hill north and west from Dan, the city of Dan, and it marks the extremity at this time of the settlements of the Israeli people. So from the extreme south to the extreme north of the settled parts of the Promised Land. That's what he's doing. So he assembled all those Israelis to bring the Ark of God from Kiriath Jearim. Now, in the 2 Samuel text, Kiriath Jearim is referred to as Baale Yoda. Here, it says, David and all Israel went up to Baala, that is, to Kiriath Jearim that belongs to Judah, to bring it up from there, the Ark of God, which is called by the name of He who is, who sits enthroned above the Kerubim. So we know exactly where Kiriath Jearim is. It is called Baala because at this time, the Israelis commonly used the Canaanite noun Baal, which literally means Lord, as a synonym for their Hebrew word Adonai, Lord. And therefore, it was a synonym for God Himself. So when the Ark of the Covenant ended up being cared for at Kiriath Jearim for a very long time, Kiriath Jearim also started being called the place of the Lord, Baala, the place of the Lord. And so that's where they have to go to collect the Ark of the Covenant, which is the throne of God, where He is seen to sit between the two cherubim that are on the Ark of the Covenant. Now, remember that they're supposed to carry the Ark of God's throne on the carrying posts. That was the requirement. But it has not been moved for several decades now. And someone, very unwisely, thought that it would be okay to just simply put it up on a new cart and transport it that way to the city of Jerusalem. So verse 3 of 2 Samuel 6 says, they carried the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God, and Ahio went before the cart. And over in the First Chronicles passage, which we've been following, says pretty much the same thing, except it doesn't explain that Ahio is the one that's out in front, kind of, you know, tugging on the harness of the animals that are pulling this this ark cart. And Abinadab and Uzzah must be on either side of this cart. Verse 8 of 1 Chronicles 13. David and all Israel were celebrating before God with all their might, with song and lyres and harps and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. So they've got all sorts of musical instruments, and they are praising the Lord because they're bringing God's throne to his new capital city. Big problem, though. They are breaking God's rules. When they came to the threshing floor of Gidon, Uzzah put out his hand to take hold of the ark, for the oxen stumbled. So he just reflexively reaches out because it looks like the ark is, you know, tipping his direction. The anger of he who is was kindled against Uzzah. He struck him down because he put out his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. So Uzzah is stricken by the fire of God, the lightning of God, because he touched something that he should not have touched.